The United States has decades of experience and invested trillions of dollars to protect our country from the conventional threat of war. But as we near possibly the most consequential presidential election of our history, are we prepared for an unconventional threat?
How shocked are we that 17-year-olds with rifles decided they had to maintain order when no one else would?
The largest single-state immigration raid in U.S. history has divided families.
My dad didn't do nothing. He's not a criminal.
They're dismantling the post office before our eyes. And this is the way fascists do things.
So I don't know how you could possibly use these ballots, these mail-in ballots.
We certainly have seen very active efforts by the Russians to influence our election in 2020.
The ruling from the state Supreme Court will allow mail-in ballots postmarked by Election Day to be received and counted until the Friday after the election, which of course could delay results.
Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transferal of power after the election?
Well, we're gonna have to see what happens.
Welcome to Unconventional Threat. I'm Jonathan Weiner.
I'm Peter Eisner.
Unconventional Threat is dedicated to three big principles. Every American with a right to vote should be able to do so. Every ballot cast must become a vote counted. And the voters choose who's president. The president does not choose who are the voters.
We need to be prepared for any possibility as we go into the election period. And we think it's our responsibility to highlight some of the issues that you should be thinking about. This first episode really sets the scene for why we're doing what we're doing. We've spoken to a broad array of very important people that have been focusing on these issues. What's the danger that we're facing these days? What are the things that we need to think about?
Earlier this year, we sat down with Congressman Jim McGovern, who is the chair of the House Committee on Rules, to share his thoughts on voter suppression.
One of our nightmare scenarios is what happens if there's voter suppression, and in some states, legitimate voters who had registered or prevented from voting due to their names having been stricken from the rolls, deliberate decisions to provide too few voting machines at a precinct, or even something worse, some computer intrusion that wipes out their names and prevents them from voting. Do you think this could happen based on what you've seen as chairman of the House Rules Committee as a congressman? And what steps do you think can be done to stop it?
Yes, I think it can happen. It has happened. I mean, voter suppression has been a tool that Republicans have used quite often over the years. I tell people all the time that one of the most important offices, you know, that in states is the Secretary of State. I mean, it's not just senator or a member of Congress or governor. The Secretary of State has enormous power. And in a lot of states, you have secretaries of state who get elected whose primary goal is to suppress the vote. To make it more difficult for people who live in urban areas where there's a large minority population to be able to vote. They limit the number of places to vote. They routinely drop people off the voting rolls. They limit the hours that you can vote. They're not flexible. If there's a big line and, you know, the polls close at 7 or 8 and you're in line, sometimes they say, well, that's it. You can't vote. So there's all kinds of, you know, things that have gone on. We in the House have passed an update of the Voting Rights Act to try to deal with some of that. Unfortunately, the Senate hasn't taken it up. But in the meantime, we need to focus on these Secretary of State races. We also need to have a legal strategy in place. The Democratic National Committee and other organizations that care about voting rights, you know, we need to raise money to be able to have a legal team in place on Election Day so when these irregularities occur, that we are immediately going to court. I think Republicans know that based on the demographics in this country and based on the trends, voting trends in this country, that they don't have much of a future. The only way they can ensure a future is to keep people from voting, is to suppress the vote. I mean, that's their magic formula for victory.
So it's a strategy.
It is a strategy. It's a deliberate strategy. And some of them have even admitted it in Republican circles, you know, have been pretty candid about it.
Well, another thing that I worry about is a nightmare scenario. In August 2019, in a Republican primary in Mississippi, there's a video that was taken of somebody trying to vote, and the man touches the voting screen for one candidate, and the machine registers it for his opponent. They're both Republicans right. In a primary. You can see it go back and forth, hits one button, registers for the other. Mississippi voting officials later acknowledged this really happened. How much risk do we face from the possibility that our voting systems could be hacked, impairing the integrity of the results and our trust, and even affecting who was elected president? And what can we do about it between now and Election Day?
Well, we do face that risk. I mean, this is not a far-fetched...
Not a fantasy.
No, it's not. It's real. And, I mean, look, we have tried on numerous occasions in our appropriations process to put more money aside to help states kind of deal with that kind of nightmare scenario, to make sure that their election systems are protected, that their elections have integrity. But it's not just, you know, you have to worry about, I don't know who was responsible for that in Mississippi, whether it was a Republican operative or not, but we have to worry just not about an opposing political party trying to fix the election. We have to worry about foreign interference. And we know that the Russians in the 2016 election had tried to hack into some of our voting system. So I expect that they will do so again. So we need to be on alert, and we need to provide the resources so states can protect these systems. Now, we have a problem right now, and that is Mitch McConnell, who has embraced the title of the Grim Reaper, who's turned the Senate into a graveyard for good legislation. We have a problem with getting him to do anything. I think they feel if they do anything that they're conceding that basically Trump's election, you know, was illegitimate. And by the way, I do think his election was illegitimate based on all the interference in the last election. I mean, he lost the election by over 3 million votes. But, given what we read in the Mueller report, given what we've heard from our intelligence briefings, I mean, the amount of interference in our election by the Russians, the disinformation campaigns, I mean, I had to believe that affected 70,000 votes in a handful of states. I have no doubt about that.
We spoke with Asha Rangappa. Asha is a former FBI special agent. She specializes in counterintelligence investigations. Asha spoke with us about the pervasiveness and effectiveness of disinformation on social media.
Okay, well, we know the CIA can't track what Americans are doing. You can only track things that are happening overseas lawfully. And they're supposed to minimize even unintended touching on American activities so that the Americans aren't identified. FBI has got the authority to do this in its counterintelligence division, the part that the organization you were part of. If the CIA can't do it and the FBI can't protect us, what's there to protect us? What's the way this needs to be looked at to be understood?
The way that this needs to be looked at to be understood is that these social media platforms have a financial interest in not taking inauthentic accounts off their platforms. Their value is based on the number of active users that they have. And if they were to accurately identify and remove all of the inauthentic accounts, then their value would fall. It is also not in their financial interest to remove disinformation, which is more has more virality on their platforms, which results in more clicks, which results in more ad revenue. So basically, you have an industry right now that I put in the same category as tobacco or gun manufacturers, where their bottom line is against what is in the interest of the public. So your options are either you rely on their self-policing, which, as I just mentioned, is probably not going to result in much. You rely on some kind of regulatory scheme, but that requires a certain amount of technological savvy among legislators, which I don't think we have right now. I mean, most of them didn't even know how Facebook makes money when Zuckerberg first came in to testify. Or you create, you know, media literacy and civic, you know, engagement and awareness among the populace. I mean, I deleted my Facebook account 3 months ago. At some point, you convince people or you make them aware that this addictive thing that they are engaging in that brings them a lot of, you know, feelings of connectivity is actually damaging to democracy. But I think those are basically the options. Depending on, you know, law enforcement or you know, CIA to somehow like stop it is not going to happen. And it's partly why Russia, Iran, China, all these people are so effective, because they can use our open society and, you know, constitutional freedoms against us.
Social media disinformation is only one option in the toolkit of foreign adversaries who wish to disrupt our democracy.
The threats from hacking and interference to the November election from foreign governments are growing as we move closer to November.
A bipartisan Senate panel says Paul Manafort, the 2016 Trump campaign chairman, was in regular contact with a Russian operative during the 2016 campaign.
We're talking about Russia. This is the one nation on Earth that has enough nuclear weapons pointed at us to wipe us off the face of the planet. And that government, he's working as we speak to get Donald Trump reelected.
We spoke with former Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Bob Menendez, and national security analyst and New York Times bestselling author, Malcolm Nance, about foreign interference in our elections. Here is Malcolm Nance.
What can you conceive of them doing as we approach the election and Election Day itself?
What can they do? Oh, they can create chaos. Real chaos, because 2016 was an information warfare attack. It's where they carried out what's called the Gerasimov Doctrine. And that was the Russian information warfare doctrine to change the mindset of foreign populations, as Gerasimov's policy document stated, to remove their own sovereignty, to let a foreign population surrender their sovereignty and essentially welcome an invasion without firing a shot or putting another person on into that country's soil. And so using information, disinformation, propaganda, and co-opting American entities like the Republican Party, the Russians in these, you know, advanced persistent threats hacked the mindset of the American voter. What can they do now? What they didn't do, as far as we can tell, in 2016, they could directly attack the American voting system, which is, I actually was criticized publicly by the Secretary of State of Florida in 2016 when I said that the Russians had entered the Florida voting systems. They insisted that never happened. It was a lie. I should be fired from MSNBC. And it turns out we found out this year they directly hacked two counties. And they can't attribute whether they changed anything, but they could do that this year. They could do it for one of two purposes. One, total mayhem in order to stoke an American civil war, which is very viable. Or number two, they could do it in order to subtly to just increase Donald Trump's chances of being reelected. But, you know, if you do number one, you get number two. So it is in their interest to create as much, you know, malignancy in the American democratic process as possible.
Here is Michael Chertoff, former Secretary of Homeland Security.
I think this goes back before the election. And it, again, is not a tribute to the managerial expertise of the current administration. But here again, we talked about politicization and trust. Even if what is delaying the ballots is just the fact that they're under-resourced and, you know, they're trying to cut back on overtime. The fact that there's a drumbeat coming out of the White House that mail ballots are nefarious suggests that there's a political motivation there. And again, that erodes trust. And you have to understand that for people who want to undermine democracy, whether they are living in this country or whether they're living in Moscow, the key is not so much who wins as can you get the public to basically think it's all rigged, it's all fake, because that's ultimately what authoritarians count on, like a Putin or an Orban, that the public will not believe in voting and the rule of law, and therefore they'll trust the strong man who says to the public, I know what you want and I will fight for you. This is a playbook that we have seen run, literally, we've seen it in South America, we've seen it in Asia, we've seen it in Europe, and we're seeing some of these tactics unfolding here in the U.S. One of the things that's interesting, though, is in 2016, when the Russians generated their own disinformation, it actually was not that effective. There weren't that many people who picked up on it and, you know, either retweeted it or liked it. But when the Russians amplified kind of misstatements or falsity that was generated by Americans, that actually did get traction. And so I think what the Russians have learned is their best play is to let Americans come up with, you know, concocted conspiracy theories or misinformation, and then using the kind of the texture of that kind of content, the Russians can then, you know, put it out there and repeat it and amplify it.
We asked Senator Bob Menendez what options we have to defend our country from foreign adversaries.
First of all, the American people have to choose, do you want to even engage in information that a foreign intelligence agency is supposedly offering? You know, do you want to accept that in the first instance? That's without regards to whether or not the information is true or fabricated, as it may very well be. You know, I sometimes wonder, do the Russians say that let it be known that they quote unquote on hacking? Because then anything that they produce is supposedly the result of the hack, even though it may not be an original document or a real document. But now you've supposedly hacked, so you got something, right? So here's what we do. So I think that both for the press, for voters, for those involved in the public discourse, whether or not we reject information that is coming from a source that we know is malign is a critical question. And then as it relates to, you know, what do we do? I think that, you know, these efforts that we have been talking about, both in preserving our electoral process in its infrastructure, as well as in, you know, in the negative cyber efforts that are going to come from abroad, you know, with Russia being the centerpiece of it, is critical. It's interesting to see that we can't get the type of election security legislation that we think is critical to protect the nation. That should not be a Democrat or Republican, issue. It should be a red, white, and blue issue. And so one must only say, if you're not willing to protect the very essence of our electoral process, then you must believe that there is a benefit in not doing so. I think there's a detriment in not doing so, and that's regardless of what the result is. But there are some who obviously will not put their votes up necessary to protect the integrity of our elections, and one can only say, well, you think there's some benefit in those outsiders playing a role.
If creating chaos in America is the goal, and sowing distrust among our fellow citizens is the strategy, then cyber attacks are very much a tactic of choice for the malevolent foreign forces working against the best interests of our country and our people. Dick Clark has served our country under four different presidents, including his role as special advisor on cybersecurity to President George W. Bush. And he's the author of numerous books, including Against All Enemies and The Fifth Domain.
Dick, you have warned in your book, The Fifth Domain, about various kinds of cyber attacks. Given what we went through in 2016, I'm worried about what we might go through in 2020. I'm worried about the integrity of our voting systems, our integrity of our databases, whether people's votes could be hacked, not just to interfere with them, but to change them,
right?
And whether we'd know if it happened. And then I worry about a bigger phenomenon. Are we at risk of entire systems being shut down through foreign malign activity? Is it paranoid? Is it a fantasy to believe that somebody could actually take our election grid off, make it impossible for people to vote that way? I'm asking that question because in our Constitution, it says that once you set an election day, nobody is allowed to vote after that day. It doesn't matter what happens. So if you've been prevented from voting on election day because it was a hurricane, because you were struck by lightning, or because an entire region of the country wasn't permitted to vote, the votes that have come in, the absentee ballots or whatever, that's all you get.
Is that right?
And in fact, any county, person responsible to certify the votes could say, I can't certify the votes. A Secretary of State could say, I can't certify the votes for our state. We don't have a result in our state for this election. And there are constitutional consequences of that. We're going to talk about those constitutional consequences. But right now, I want to understand from you, are these realistic threats, or am I worrying about things that are just not possible?
Well, let's take the election system and break it down. I think of the election system as three components. One, you've got the campaigns and the parties. Are they any more secure than they were in 2016 when John Podesta's emails were hacked and the DNC was hacked and all of that?
Have any of them talked to you to ask that question, or you talked to them?
I'd rather not answer that. The truth is that they're not much better off than they were 4 years ago. Only one campaign on the Democratic side that I know of has a full-time chief information security officer. In other words, some cyber defense guy, full-time professional cyber defense guy. Only one of the campaigns, as far as I can tell. And the DNC, I don't think, is much better off either. A little bit better. But look, if the GRU wants to get into the DNC, if it wants to get into any of these campaigns, it's a cakewalk. So that's the first part.
The GRU, is the Russian intelligence service that did it to us in 2016.
The Russian military intelligence service that did it to us in 2016.
These are the people who Bob Mueller indicted.
Right. Exactly. By name. Individuals. So that's the first part of the three parts. The second part is the voter data lists, the registries. Is your name on the voter list, and does it have your right address and the right precinct? Because, you know, you cannot in this country go to the wrong voter precinct, you go to the wrong fire station, and you can't vote. You have to go to the right one. They tried to manipulate, or they tried to get in anyway, to voter data registration lists in almost all the states. And if that sounds like an extreme statement, you can back that up with a lot of facts, a lot of details.
But Democrats and Republicans are going to be fighting about all kinds of things. Democrats may be trying to get votes out. Republicans may be trying to suppress votes in those states. They're going to be fighting about election rules, whatever. It's a different thing when a foreign country comes in and intervenes and changes what happens in our country.
Mm-hmm.
So what I am focused on in particular, in addition to getting us to protect ourselves,
could there be a disaster?
Could there be a disaster? Yeah. Could there be a nightmare? And is it realistic or is it a fantasy, this notion that the lights could go out and people could be prevented from voting in one state or in more states?
Look, I think it is very clear that you can take down parts of the power grid. The director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, at the time, last year, testified before Congress that the Russians are in the control system for our power grid. Not that they were, but they are. He painted a picture based on the 17 U.S. intelligence agencies report that the Russians have infiltrated, and the Chinese as well, have infiltrated controls for things like the power grid and the natural gas pipeline system. Now, if you think about the pipelines, we've converted so much from coal to natural gas for power generation that if you don't have natural gas getting to the through the pipelines to the power plants, they can't generate electricity. There are two vulnerable systems. And, you know, people used to say I was crazy when I said you could bring down an electric grid through hacking. And then the Russians did in Ukraine. And then they did it again in Ukraine. And now the federal government admits publicly that it could happen. The United States has also leaked officially out of the White House that, well, we're in the Russian power grid too. Well, if we're in the Russian power grid, that must mean you can take down power grids, right? So the answer to your question is yes, a foreign country can do regional, at least, power blackouts at a time of its choosing. And if they chose to do that on election day, I don't know what the law is about, you know, do-overs, but it would certainly cause a lot of chaos and distrust of the system, which is their goal.
Attacks on our voting infrastructure are not limited to Russia. Priscilla Moriucci is an expert on state-sponsored cyber operations and Asia-Pacific regional and cyber threats. She spoke with us about cyber attacks from China and North Korea.
Their goals in relation to how they execute certain operations, influence operations, cyber operations, are different because distrust in organizations, distrust in government is not a stop on the way to their goal, right? So if we talk about, would China conduct an investigation into the Bidens and then strategically release the information? I would say I don't think they're at that point yet. So China has been conducting successful cyber operations, we'd call them espionage, against political campaigns since at least 2008. If you remember, both Senator McCain and at the time Senator Obama's campaigns were victimized by Chinese hackers.
Can you unpack that a little bit? Tell us a little more about how candidate Obama and candidate McCain's campaigns were victimized.
Sure. Their campaign headquarters, I believe it was via spear phishing, were both essentially intruded upon, right? Documents were stolen that were sort of internal messaging or political documents belonging to the campaigns. The documents never turned up anywhere. Right. And this is something that you'll see is common with Chinese operations, right, is the sensitive information that's stolen doesn't make it out onto the so-called dark web or in these sort of criminal marketplaces, because the Chinese keep a much stronger hold on this type of data. And it's used right by the state for state and intelligence purposes. And that's what happened in 2008 and in successive presidential elections afterwards.
We've been here before. Many people strongly believe that the result of this year's election will be delayed by days or weeks. But even in the hotly contested presidential election of 2000, when we waited 36 days for a final result, our democracy prevailed with a peaceful transition of power.
We call Florida in the Al Gore column.
Stand by, stand by. CNN right now is moving our earlier declaration of Florida back to the too close to call column.
The vice president has recalled the governor and retracted his concession.
Just moments ago, I spoke with George W. Bush and congratulated him on becoming the 43rd president of the United States. And I promised him that I wouldn't call him back this time.
Here are Senator Tim Worth and media executive Tom Rogers on what to expect and what we can do. Tom, are there particular states we should be looking at as to where this could play out? And have we seen signs that people are planning to do it?
The sign that made very clear that this is more than a hypothetical possibility and more than just a bad news scenario that is conceivable but unlikely is Donald Trump about 10 days ago when asked about the mail-in ballots, actually spoke about the fact that, well, at some point, Congress makes the determination, which kind of let out of the bag that this was conscious strategic thinking that clearly had happened in front of him that he was aware of and often speaks of things that maybe he's not supposed to disclose, and it's in his head, and he does, and he blurted it out in that instance. Since then, there have been a number of times where he's talked about how this could go to the Supreme Court, this could go to Congress, and made very clear that if it did go to Congress, they have an advantage in the House of Representatives where, under some scenario, this ultimately could end up. And so it's become very clear this is conscious thinking on the part of the Trump campaign that this is a path they may well go down.
Senator Tim Worth.
Citizens at all levels have to be very patient and wait for the full count to come in. We know that the count will be different between the votes that are cast on Election Day and those that are sent in by mail. It's going to take a long time for those votes to be counted. That delay is room for a lot of mischief during that 2 or 3 week period of time after November 3rd. Citizens have to be patient. That's part of the citizens' firewall against mischief.
If we do not have a clear winner decided by the Electoral College, there is a danger to our democracy because of a little known and barely understood weapon all presidents have. Presidential emergency powers.
We asked former Senator Gary Hart to explain.
How could secret emergency powers be used to create a dictatorship in the United States? Don't we have rule of law and judges and courts and Congress and lots of protections? How could this possibly happen?
Well, that's the question, and we don't know. When I learned in April that these secret powers existed or are reported to have existed, I started canvassing friends of mine who had held senior government positions in various administrations. And a surprising number of them replied to my inquiry that they knew nothing about these secret powers. That's question number one. How can one be Secretary of Defense, have in the White House the ability of the president to suspend the Constitution, and the Secretary of Defense doesn't know about that? The same is true of the Secretary of State. Even more puzzling was the fact that I contacted people I had known and served with in Congress and other capacities and asked them to tell me what they knew about the secret powers. And some of them refused to respond. These are secrets wrapped in a mystery. What is it so secret about these powers that people who know about them, who have to know about them, refuse to acknowledge knowing about them?
How concerned should we be about the possibility of a dictator in the White House? I read a study that was done by a political scientist 25 or 30 years ago, which looked at the characteristics of a fascist dictator and of the fascist movement in its classical sense, that is the Italian Mussolini fascism, rather than the particular form that took place in Germany. And I checked off the boxes, and I looked at the boxes, and the boxes included things like attacking the press, getting intelligence and law enforcement under the control of the executive, many other of the elements that we've seen play out over the last few years. To what extent are you worried about essentially authoritarian rule in the United States being an outcome which this country could be faced with in the future? Is that a crazy idea? Is it a realistic idea? Or is it something we just can't assess right now?
Well, those who have studied the issue that we're discussing have described what they know about the secret powers as a blueprint for dictatorship. If those powers include the suspension of habeas corpus, peaceful assembly, authorized mass arrests, and warrantless searches and seizures, and the list goes on, that's about as close to a dictatorship as you can get. So that's why we have to find out what these powers are. And for those who defend them, saying, well, that's just a strong president, well, good luck with that.
Here again is Senator Tim Wirth.
12th Amendment issues was the first of the two major issues that our group, Keep Our Republic, focused on. The second was to try to better understand the vast emergency powers held by the President of the United States. Unknown to most Americans, and certainly, and also unknown to most members of Congress, the president has a very large array of emergency powers. Originally, some were granted to him at the time of the threat of nuclear attack during the Eisenhower era. And quite justifiably, we had to figure out what would happen if. So emergency powers were then packaged and given to the president. Since then, those emergency powers have expanded with the threats of biological warfare, chemical warfare, terrorism, and most recently, a pandemic. And the president now has a whole suite of powers which have been granted to him, but about which the Congress knows almost nothing. There have been no votes in the United States Congress. There have been no hearings in the United States Congress. These powers have slowly but surely accreted to the president over many, many years. And our concern is that these powers can be very dangerous if improperly used by a president. For example, a president can waive habeas corpus. President can waive the constitutional provisions protecting against searches and seizures. The president can shut down the internet. The president has a vast array of powers which can be used. Our worry was if these election, if these powers are used during the counting of an election, they can skew the results of that election. And so we tried to get after that, understand it. We found that very few members of Congress, if any, know anything about these at all. We thought it would be up to us to help to illuminate these powers. Our concerns are very real indeed, and we think that the counting of the votes at the time of the Electoral College coming together can indeed be skewed by the president and can indeed be skewed by the emergency powers which he and the Attorney General may wield. So those are the two concerns of Keep Our Republic, the counting, the Electoral College Act, and second, the emergency powers held by the president.
On more than one occasion, President Trump has told us he will not commit to leaving the White House of his own volition, no matter who is the lawful next president of the United States.
And we're going to win four more years in the White House. Based on the way we were treated, we're probably entitled to another four after that.
When Donald Trump jokes about 12 more years, he's not joking.
It's kind of stunning that a president of the United States, from the podium at the White House, is unwilling to commit to a peaceful transfer of power.
The only way we're going to lose this election is if the election is rigged. Remember that.
Senator Bob Menendez is the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Americans are free to disagree with the law, but they're not free to disobey it. At the end of the day, it would be a constitutional crisis, but I would expect that even this Supreme Court, of which he has had a majority of the appointees, would find that as a straw that broke the camel's back, as a bridge too far. And of course, the court has the power to call out the National Guard and the Army to enforce its orders. I can't imagine that that would be the case, but, you know, that's when the essence of our democracy and our Constitution would be tested.
Lawrence B. Wilkerson is a retired United States Army colonel who served as Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. We asked Colonel Wilkerson for his expert opinion on how the military might react if any president refused to leave office.
But what you're telling me is that with all of the institutional integrity that we have and all the tradition and buildup, is that you don't know, after all your years of service in the military, what would happen if the military was faced with these kinds of conundrums.
No, and I'm also very aware of what's happened to countries in history who formed empires and formed militaries to protect those empires. And if I were speaking to you from strictly a historical point of view, I'd say watch out. Don't convince yourself it can't happen.
You're saying it can happen?
Yes. Yes. That's exactly what I'm saying.
And what's the it? What is the it that can happen in 2020?
That the military would throw its weight to what in effect would be a coup d'etat.
So you think we should, as we look at 2020, not rule coup d'etat out of the picture?
Very sophisticated, not looking like a coup d'etat, yes.
And do you think it's possible that if Donald Trump loses the popular vote by millions of votes and loses a electoral college vote, if it were to be counted, that he might decide to stay anyway?
That's one of the high severity, low probability scenarios being looked at.
And why high severity and why low probability?
High severity because it destroys our republic. We are at least possessed of a few democratic tendencies. We've destroyed a lot of them, but there are still a few. One of them is the ballot box. Another one is the rule of law, as it is influential within a liberal democracy. We're rapidly trying to eat that one away, erode it, kill it. But there are a few aspects of this empire that could be called democratic with some validity. We'd take those out with that. And so one of the things I felt for Dick Cheney for, Dick Cheney said if we have another attack, particularly if it's a low-yield nuclear weapon or a dirty bomb, we will lose our republic. Martial law will be declared, not just in the area where the munition went off, but across the country, and we will never get it back. We will never get our republic back. Dick Cheney was right, I think. And he said, this is where I think he erred, maybe not, but I think he did, I'm willing to do anything to prevent that outcome, anything. And so we went to torture, we went to lying, you know.
Some people at times say that with the wild swings and impulsiveness of this president, they're always looking to somebody, and they always use the term the adults in the room,
right?
Who, a lot of whom have been cast aside. But those of us who've watched the military over the last 30 years conduct diplomacy better sometimes than others say that maybe a committee of high-level military would be prepared and be ready for extreme events to take place before they take place, and maybe protect us in some way. Is that spurious?
Well, that's, if you look back on history all the way back to Athens, Rome, there is an element of that in almost every imperial decline that looks good at the time. It looks like it has bona fides. It looks like it really is the only course of action. It looks like it could be recovered from eventually. And yet, in most cases, it isn't. It isn't any of those things. And once power is obtained in that sort of way, and once it proves itself, as Churchill said, the best form of government is a benevolent dictatorship. The problem is the transition. What we have licked in 200 some odd years is we've made transition after transition after transition without major chaos. We've had some tough ones, but we have made the transition. We're talking about now coming to a point where we may be on the verge of destroying that last rubric, that last piece of our democracy that still stands and allows for these peaceful transitions every 4 years or every 8 years, whatever it may be. Once you've done that, there's no going back. And if your initial experience with that verifies more or less, and the tendency probably would be to do just that it is a better government, then you've cemented that kind of government probably for the foreseeable future. But where do you find the next tyrant? Where do you find the next benevolent dictator? Hmm. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It ain't kind of nice, as Henry Kissinger said, quipping. It does. It is the ultimate corrupter.
These are deeply troubling times for all Americans. Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals, everybody in between and those on the fringes. We're all impacted by the scourge of the pandemic, the devastation of the economy, and the threat of domestic discord. It's easy and understandable for us to lose heart.
We've had 244 years of democracy, and we're fortunate enough to be living at a moment in which we ourselves can make the choice. Does it matter enough to us to fight for our right to vote? Does it matter enough for us to stand up and say, this is our democracy, and we're going to push ahead and make it work?
We've asked former House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt for his thoughts.
People complain to me all the time about the polarization that's in the country and about people that they think are behaving badly and that Congress is a mess and it can't do anything and that people are only interested in themselves and they don't care about the country and on and on and on. I get all that. And clearly there's room for saying all of that, because all of that has been present. But I spent 40 years in public service, and all I did whenever I went back home, or if I was at home in one of my city jobs, is I went door to door. I went door to door incessantly, hour after hour after hour. That's all I did. And the reason I did that was because I realized that if people didn't know me, as a human being and didn't believe that I cared about them, and even if they disagreed with me on most of the issues, that I was trying to do what I thought was best for everybody, that I could not be reelected and I shouldn't be reelected. I had to have that connection with the people. And I must tell you, I've been to millions of doors in those 40 years. Even when I ran for president, that's what I did in Iowa and New Hampshire. I went door to door. And my belief is that, you know, nobody's perfect, but the vast majority of the American people are really good people. They want the right things for our country. They want the right outcomes. They care about their community. They care about their families. They care about what they're doing. And they want to do the right things. And they want leadership. And they want honest, good leadership. So that's always given me optimism about this country. That's the most important thing.
Subscribe to Unconventional Threat on your favorite podcast app and sign up for breaking news from Unconventional Threat at unconventionalthreat.com. Unconventional Threat is a project of Keep Our Republic and is produced by District Productive. Unconventional Threat is the creation of Jonathan Weiner, Peter Eisner, and Paul Woodhull. Our executive producer is Peter Ogburn. Our associate producer is McKenna Chester. Keep Our Republic aims to discover, highlight, and help to prevent an array of extraordinary threats to the integrity of the 2020 election and transition. To learn more, go to keepourrepublic.com. Jonathan Weiner, Gary Hart, Dick Gebhardt, and Tom Rogers are members of Keep Our Republic. Tim Wirth is a co-founder and member of Keep Our Republic. To find more great podcasts from District Productive, go to districtproductive.com.